It's my pleasure to have Yizhuang Yu as today's speaker. So Yizhuang is currently a professor in San Diego. And today I was looking at Yizhuang's homepage, and it was very hard to find a topic that Yizhuang hasn't worked on in condensed matter physics. So he has a very broad research interest and many interesting results. And today we will hear about how quenching and observation affect quantum dynamics. Okay, Yizhuang.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Sansik, for the introduction. And also thank Anton team, Yangbek and Sansik, for organizing this wonderful virtual seminar series. And I'm also very glad to have the chance to talk on this seminar theory. So today I want to tell you a story that we recently work on about quantum quenches in the presence of decoherence. So the project is still in preparation, not published. I'm collaborating with Smitha from UIUC and also Daniel Arribas at UCSD and his student Weiting Guo. And Weiting is the driving force of this research. So we want to think about the motivation of our studies to explore the effect of measurement in quantum dynamics. And when we talk about quantum dynamics, we usually think about unitary evolution, where a quantum state evolves under Schrodinger equation coherently. But there is another process in quantum mechanics which can change the quantum state, which is the measurement. So under measurement, the quantum state will basically collapse into the measurement basis. And then this process is not unitary. And this is beyond the description of the simple description of Schrodinger equation. And we actually know that, in fact, measurement is a many-body effect. It actually has to do with the fact that the system is interacting with the environment. And even if the system, even if we do not set up an apparatus and intentionally try to measure the system, environment is also still measuring the system or monitoring the system through the system-environment interaction. And this environmental monitoring effect will typically lead to phenomenon of energy and things like that. So these effects will actually modify the quantum dynamics of the system. So that's what we want to explore in this research. And then incorporating measurement into quantum dynamics has led to many fruitful progress recently. And one interesting system is actually this hybrid quantum circuit, which contains unitary gates and also local measurements. And this local measurement can be inserted either with probabilities at different positions, or it can be inserted uniformly in the in each layer, but we consider, for example, weak measurement such that the strength of the measurement can be tuned. So conditional on the measurement outcome, or let's say post-selected by the measurement outcome, the final steady state can exhibit different entanglement properties. It can either be area law entangled or volume law entangled, depending on the strength of the measurement. And by tuning the strength of the measurement, one can even drive a transition between this area law and volume law entangled phase of the final state. So that's what is known as the measurement-induced entanglement transition. That has been recently studied by a lot of people. And then even within this volume law, area law phase, they can be further separated into different, let's say, symmetry breaking phases, which is a story that we heard about last week in Hood's talk. So at least some recent work shows that at least in the area law phase, measurement can stabilize different quantum orders. That includes symmetry breaking order or SPT order or topological order. So if that is the case, and if we can also tune, it is also fine that we can tune a parameter in this measurement protocol to go from one phase to another phase stabilized by the measurement. So if that is the case, then we can ask an interesting question. Can we tune this parameter continuously and then drive the system from one measurement stabilized phase to another measurement stabilized phase through a quantum phase transition? And this process will be a quantum quench. And then this will happen dynamically. So we want to know what's the difference between the quantum quench if we are quenching through unitary dynamics, or if we are quenching under the influence of this strong effect of measurement. So that's what we want to explore. In particular, we know that through this quantum quench, through the critical points, there's usually universal behaviors of the scaling behaviors associated with that. So we want to know all these scaling behaviors, how is that affected by measurement? And one interesting thing to notice is that in these works, what typically are being measured are local operators, local terms in the Hamiltonian. So that is as if the environment is trying to monitor the energy of the system, because you are measuring terms in the Hamiltonian. So that's the energy operator that is being measured. So this idea of environment preferentially measuring energy of the system, I think is a very interesting one, which leads to some notion of an open quantum system, but that is not fully open. Let me explain what I mean by that. So when we talk about open quantum system, what we have in mind is that we have a system and we embed the system in an environment, and then there is some interaction term that couples the system and environment together. So it depends on how we set up the interaction term. Of course, the most trivial case is that the interaction term is zero, then the system doesn't talk to the environment. That's what we note. That's what we call the closed quantum system. And such that in that case, there's no energy flow between the system and environment. There's also no information flow. By information flow, I mean that the system and environment cannot establish quantum entanglement. And there's no quantum information that communicates between system and environment if there's no coupling between them. So in that case, for a closed quantum system, it will just evolve in time coherently under the Schrodinger equation. That's the most trivial case. Maybe let's say simplest case. And then there's open quantum system where this interaction is non-zero. But depending on whether this interaction term commutes or not commutes with the system Hamiltonian, it can be further separated into these two different scenarios. So one is that if the interaction term commutes with the system Hamiltonian, then the energy of the system is still conserved. Under this dynamics, at least if we consider the Hamiltonian is time independent, in the static case, there's still a conservation of the notion of a conservation of energy if the interaction term commutes with the system Hamiltonian. In that case, the system can only establish entanglement with the environment, or we can say that the system can communicate with environment by spreading out quantum informations. So there's still information flow, but there's no energy flow. So in that sense, the system is like a partially open. And that's actually, that typically leads to a phenomenon like quantum decoherence. And there's also other scenarios where the interaction term does not commute with the system Hamiltonian. That's the most general case where the system can have information and energy flow with the environment both. So that energy flow can lead to maybe dissipation of a system's energy. So I would like to say this is like our situation in the lockdown of the pandemic. So we want to consider if we fully lock down our system, that's like a closed system. But if we fully open, that's also not good because the virus will spread. So we want to hold this virtual seminar. So this virtual seminar is like a virtually open system where we cannot travel across the border and give talks and meet each other physically, but we can still communicate with each other online through this virtual form, that we can communicate ideas in the form of information, but we don't physically travel in the form of maybe energy. So that's the idea. So basically, we want to focus on this so-called virtually open system, which only has entanglement, quantum entanglement, or it only communicates through measurement. So, so the one most apparent scenario for the case that the system Hamiltonian commutes with the interaction Hamiltonian is that the interaction Hamiltonian exactly takes the form of the system Hamiltonian tensor product with some other random, let's say, any other Hermitian operator that acts on the environment. So this is the case. Of course, there are more cases that you can write down given this commutation. But I think without a further assumption of symmetry or other details, I think this is one apparent scenario, which means that the system only coupled to the environment through its energy operator, and the environment will also only monitor the energy of the system. I think that's, so that's limit our scope to this scenario and then see what's the effect of environment trying to monitor the energy of the system. And we also want to consider the case in a continuous setup, which means that the measurement happens not projectively, but actually weakly, meaning that it can environment weakly monitor the energy of the system throughout the process. So this can be carried out by a so-called continuous indirect measurement. Well, the protocol is like this. The environment starts with some random ancilla state, and then the environment will evolve with the system jointly under the governed by this interaction Hamiltonian. And we consider that evolution happened for a short time, such that it established some amount of very little amount of entanglement between the system and environment. And then the environment is being measured strongly that collapsed to a measurement basis. So this will induce a weak measurement on the system through this coupling. And then the effect that this procedure imposed on the system density matrix can be described by this cross operator formulation, where the system density matrix will evolve under this process by sandwiching by the cross operator and summing over all the measurement outcomes in the environment. And the cross operator is given by the infinitesimal evolution operator generated by the interaction Hamiltonian and projected to the initial and final states of the environment. So if we expand the previous cross operator in terms of this small parameter epsilon, which parameterizes the short time evolution, then we can actually try to figure out how does the density matrix of the system evolves in this process. So the infinitesimal evolution, actually, if we expand to epsilon to the second power, it goes like this. It has to do with the commutator of the system Hamiltonian and the density matrix and also the double commutator. So we don't want to impose a lot of assumption on the environment. So we just think that the environment is just some random quantum system. And then we don't even want to specify how the system couple with the environment, maybe couple with a random operator. We also don't want to specify what's the initial state. So maybe that's a random state. So if we consider this operator and the states in the environment are random, then under ensemble average, the first term just vanishes. But the second term is a positive definite quantity. So it will has a finite ensemble average, even if you consider random operator and random states. And that finite answer, if we take the time goes continuous time limit appropriately, that will define a quantity, which is the measurement strength, this gamma, that corresponds to the strength of the measurement, or you can say it's the strength of the decoherence. So basically in the continuum.
Yeah. Could I have a question?
Yes.
Do you assume that the environment doesn't evolve in time because you give phi fixed, or you also can change phi?
Yeah, we don't care too much about how the environment precisely evolves in time, because we think that, of course, phi can also evolve in time, but environment is so complicated and scrambled so fast. So the assumption is that every time when we try to do this weak measurement, the system is facing a different environment, and then we don't want to really coherently specify how the environment is evolving in time. So it's like every time there's a random environment coming in and try to monitor the system's energy. Yeah.
May I have a question?
Yes.
Technically, what does random operator mean?
It's a random Hermitian operator. You can think of it from GUE ensemble, let's say, a random Hermitian operator. And then the state is also a hard random state, let's say. to be specific. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so given that kind of assumption, we can kind of derive the time evolution equation for the density matrix. So this term, the double commutator, comes from the measurement procedure, and then there's a coefficient in the front that corresponds to the measurement strength or the decoherence strength. We'll also put in by hand the first term, which comes from the unitary evolution, because anyway, the system is still evolving. Still evolved by the unitary evolution generated by the Hamiltonian of the system. So the whole equation takes the form of a Lindblad equation, where the second term actually is the Lindblad term, and then the Lindblad operator is a double commutator form of the Lindblad equation, where the Lindblad operator here is the Hamiltonian itself. So it's so both the unitary evolution and the non-unitary, let's say, decoherence are driven by the same Hamiltonian in this case. And this equation has appeared in the literature many times. And then this equation typically in the literature, it describes decoherent in certain operator basis. And here we want to consider decoherence in the energy basis because environment is measuring the energy of the system. So that's why the Lindblad operator turns out to be the Hamiltonian of the system itself. So we want to study the effect of this kind of dynamics if we tune the Hamiltonian in time.
Question?
Question, okay.
Can you go back?
Okay.
I wonder if the last equation, the expectation value of phi a squared with respect to phi, is this a consequence of the random matrix theory?
Not quite. Actually, if you sum over this measurement basis, they're like inserting certain complete basis, and then you can already obtain this form, this term, and then you take an ensemble average of this quantity. We don't even specify the ensemble because this quantity is anyway positive. A is a Hermitian operator, so a square is a positive operator, so its expectation value is positive. So if you ensemble average certain positive numbers, you anyway don't get a zero answer, you will get a finite answer in any case.
But it seems the content of this equation is that there's a epsilon going to zero limit.
This is very tricky of taking this limit. It seems that it turns out that you need to take the limit with the time. This is the physical time. It's epsilon, you should think of it more as a parameter other than a physical time.
Uh-huh.
It should be taken to zero as this ratio fixed.
Okay, I see. But does this need any justification or?
Yeah, this is just a phenomenon of a quantum Zeno effect. If you really think this epsilon is a physical time, then the system just don't evolve if you measure so frequently. So you need to take the limit in a sensible way such that the system can still have a evolution. You basically need to pack this all this effect into this coefficient gamma.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so but I think that derivation is not new. It's not our derivation. That's actually kind of standard in deriving how quantum system decohere in any basis. It can, if you want to say decohere in the position basis or momentum basis, you just insert position or momentum operator here. Or in the spin basis, maybe inserting spin operator.
Yi Zhuang, in the Lindblad equation, you already averaged over the ancillary state.
Yes, we already averaged over the environment such that in this equation, I'm omitting the system subscripts such that.
And then the first term on the right-hand side was added by hand or?
Yeah, it's because we are thinking about a quantum system which not only evolve under measurement, right? There's one layer of measurement which just describes what's the change of the density matrix after measurement, but there's also a layer of unitary. And the unitary may be generated by this Hamiltonian. So that will also lead to the dynamics of the density matrix. So that's why the two terms need to be added together. So the first term is describing the unitary evolution. Yeah.
Then for that term, should I think epsilon to be delta t?
For that term, yeah, epsilon is just delta t. For that term, actually, that's the standard derivation of the unitary evolution of a density matrix. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there's a limit where both terms are well defined in the small delta t epsilon limit.
The small time interval is taken differently for the weak measurement and the unitary evolution. Unitary evolution, the just evolve by delta t time, and the measurement will evolve because it's more subtle. Measurement will evolve by some small parameter, and then to parameterize a weak measurement precision.
Oh, it's a different.
Yeah,
they're different evolution.
The time interval doesn't need to be the same between measurement and unitary. They're kind of two different processes, but they just repeat and continue, and you just repeat them in time.
Okay, thank you.
Such that in general, it's more like in general, the equation will take this form, and then we pack all these very subtle detail into a coefficient. And in the future, we just tune this coefficient, not worrying about too much about the detail there. So in order to have some better understanding or intuition of this equation, let's look at a very simple toy model where my Hamiltonian only has two levels. So it's a 2x2 Hamiltonian where there's a diagonal term which has a gap, energy gap, delta. And then correspondingly, the density matrix will also be a 2x2 density matrix. And it turns out that the diagonal matrix element of the density matrix won't evolve under this equation. But the off-diagonal matrix element, this row 0, 1, will actually has a non-trivial evolution equation. And the differential equation, if you solve that, that has a solution that takes this form, which has a phase, rotating phase that's with respect to time given by this energy delta, the gap delta. And also has an envelope by an exponentially suppressed or exponentially decay function. That actually describes the decoherence effect that the density matrix, off-diagonal matrix element of the density matrix goes to zero as time evolves. So that's the decoherence. From that, we can actually read out the decoherence time, which is inversely proportional to the square of the energy gap between the two states. So I try to say the fact that the decoherence time is inversely proportional to the gap square will be very important in the later discussion. So this is just trying to establish this kind of intuition in a very simple toy model. But in reality, we are going to consider this zero as the ground state of our quantum many body system. And delta basically is the excited state. And then delta basically characterizes the typical energy scale of low-lying excitation in our quantum many body system. So that's how we're going to use this kind of formulation. So with all these setup, we can now start to consider quantum quench through continuous phase transition. So what we have in mind is that there may be a phase diagram, which we may have different phases separated by phase transition. And we consider they are, for example, a continuous phase transition that you can tune a parameter to go from one phase to another. So continuously tuning this parameter corresponds to actually perturbing the critical theory. Suppose the critical theory, the critical point can be described by a conformal field theory. So there will be a CFT Hamiltonian. You perturb that with some relevant perturbation that drives the transition. And the coefficient of that relevant perturbation is going to change with respect to time. And then we consider a continuously tuning this parameter such that in the vicinity of this critical point, you can always linearize. However you want to tune it, you can always linearize that tuning near the critical point. We will just consider linear tuning in that case. And then there's a parameter tau, which is the quench time, or you can say 1/tau is the quench rate that specify how fast we are going to tune our parameter through the critical line. So this is the setup of our time-dependent Hamiltonian. So given this Hamiltonian, as we quench through the critical transition, what happens in the vicinity of the transition is actually the correlation length of the quantum system will actually diverge with the tuning parameter with the exponent, which is called exponent nu. And then since our tuning parameter goes with time linearly, so we can also translate that divergent correlation length as something that diverges with this time with certain exponents. And correspondingly, the excitation gap will also close at a critical point. The gap will close in a manner that is related to the correlation length to the minus z. Z is the dynamical exponent. And we can also translate that into something that depends on time. So actually the gap will close with respect to time in a power law manner. And as the excitation gap closes, all the dynamical process of the quantum system just slow down. And the quantum system, when it slows down so much that eventually at the point that the system cannot respond to the fast changing, to the tuning of the of this parameter, of this tuning parameter, then the system will necessarily fall out of equilibrium as it goes through the quantum critical transition. So there are two relevant time scale of the quantum dynamics in this problem. One is the correlation time, which tells us how fast the system responds to the tuning coherently in terms of quantum dynamics. So the coherent time is set by 1/1 the excitation gap. And then that scales with time in this manner. And then another typical time scale is the decoherence time. This is specifying how fast the system decoheres into the energy eigenstate. It takes some time for the decoherence to happen. So that decoherent time will scale with the square, 1/square of the gap, which is different from the correlation time. So that's why it will scale with time in a different manner. And because the two powers are different, so if we somehow plot the coherent time, the correlation time and the coherence time, as a function of our tuning parameter, although both of them will diverge at the critical point where the tuning parameter goes to zero, but they will diverge with different powers. So because the power is different, so these two power law function will necessarily have a crossing. And then this crossing means that depending on how fast we tune our system through the critical point, the behavior of the dynamics will become different. So if we somehow tune our system rather slowly, meaning that, so let me explain this figure, the horizontal axis is our tuning parameter, but the vertical axis is time. So as we, before the quench, as we go towards the critical point, so the time is counting down. And then after we go through the critical point, the time just goes forward again. So this is this black line basically indicates how the parameter changes as we tune the time down and up through the critical point. And then if we tune it slowly, then the slope will be rather large. Then what we will have is this scenario that our time scale will first fall below the decoherence time scale. So after our time scale, dynamical time scale falls below the decoherent time scale, the system can no longer respond to the tuning by decoherence, but still system can still respond to the tuning by the quantum dynamics, which is described by the correlation time, until our dynamical time scale falls even below the correlation time, which is here. Then the system will enter a region where the dynamics is effectively frozen because there's no dynamical process that can be fast enough to respond to the tuning. So the system enters this non-adiabatic regime that the system effectively doesn't respond, and then the state will froze. So the time scale that the system freezes is also called the frozen time. And then the frozen time in this case is set by, if you take this correlation time and set that to equal to the physical time. And by solving that equation, you can find that the frozen time scale is set by the quench time to a certain power. And that power has to do with all the critical exponents of this quantum phase transition. And correspondingly, there's also a frozen length scale that's also related to the quench time in another power. And these scaling behaviors are well known as the Kibo-Zuri scaling. And then that's expected in the slow quench limit, because when the quench is slow, so by slow quench, how do I mean slow or fast? So slow, it means that the quench time is longer than a typical time scale that's set by the decoherent rate, by the decoherent strength in this power. So that's the case when the decoherent, in another way of saying, you can also say that's the case when the decoherence is weak. So in the weak decoherent limit, of course, we go back to our original understanding of quantum quench in the unitary evolution. However, if our decoherent is strong, or another way of saying that is we quench the system rather fast. In that sense, the quench time is smaller than this time scale set by the decoherence rate. Then we will have a scenario where the slope actually is small, that actually go across this crossing point, such that when we approach the critical point, we first fall below the coherence time scale, and then we fall below the decoherence time scale. And when we fall below the decoherent time scale, the system effectively frozen. So the frozen time will now be determined by the intersection of this black line and the purple line, the decoherence time scale. So that will follow a different scaling behavior, because if you set this time scale to be the physical time, by solving that equation, you will end up with some other solution. And that solution, it has a different exponent with respect to this quench time. So that's the different scaling behavior under the strong decoherence. So we want to test whether we can see this kind of different scaling in a system which we have which has a strong decoherence. So the model that we actually try to study as a model to exemplify this kind of new scaling is this Chern insulator transition. So this is a very simple model. It's a free fermion model where we consider a 2+1 dimensional spinless fermion. It's a free fermion, and then it has a time dependent band structure. So the Hamiltonian basically is a free fermion Hamiltonian, and we consider a two band system such that the Hamiltonian can be described, single particle Hamiltonian described by a Pauli matrix coupled to this Hamiltonian vector. And the Hamiltonian vector is tuned in time such that the two bands will actually close the band gap and reopen as we tune the system through the transition. And we assume that by tuning, So near the band closing points, the system can be described by a Dirac fermion model, where the tuning parameter effectively corresponds to the mass of the Dirac fermion. And we consider tuning the Dirac fermion mass linear in time in this manner, such that when we tune through the transition, on one hand, if you want to consider the ground state of the system, then it will go from one Chern insulator phase to another Chern insulator phase. So we actually start with the system, start by preparing the system in its ground state. And then we do a quantum quench and quench through this transition. After the transition, some part of the, some state, some single particle state will actually be left lifted to the excited band. So that leads to some excitation left over after the quench. So that's the behavior. That's the result that the system actually fall out of equilibrium through the quench. That creates some excitation in the system. So this kind of scenario has been discussed extensively in many previous research a few years ago. But we want to revisit this system because we want to consider the decoherence effect, which is new, which we added to the system. But the Hamiltonian we consider is just this simple Hamiltonian with tuning the fermion mass term. And then fermion system is described by a density matrix. And fortunately for this free fermion system, the density matrix is particularly simple. It can be factorized into product of a single particle density matrix at every momentum point. And at every momentum point, the single particle density matrix just takes the form of a Pauli, take a 2x2 matrix form, which can be parameterized by this coefficient in front of the Pauli matrix. Well, this coefficient, it's a three component a real vector, which you can call it a pseudo spin, which is related to the expectation value of this fermion operator. So by monitor, how basically the goal is to solve the dynamical equation and try to figure out how the pseudo spin vector at every momentum point evolve with respect to time. And the dynamical equation, if we plug in all these into our Lindblad equation, it basically reduced to an equation for the pseudo spin. And then this is the equation that contains the pseudo spin and also this Hamiltonian vector. So the Hamiltonian vector in this case just plays the role of like a magnetic field, like a pseudo magnetic field. So the pseudo spin dynamics contains two terms. The first term actually describes the pseudo spin precession under the influence of the pseudo magnetic field set by the Hamiltonian. So the second term will actually describe the decoherent effect, which try to pull the pseudo spin to the collinear direction of the pseudo magnetic field. So in the weak decoherent limits, well, the dynamics is governed by the first term, and we can make a simulation and we can try to tune our pseudo magnetic field, which is our Hamiltonian. We can try to tune our Hamiltonian, let's say from this blue vector to the red vector, tuning it. And correspondingly, the pseudo spin vector will also evolve in time in certain way. And then that's actually some evolution that is dominated by the pseudo spin precession according to this tuning of the magnetic field. So that is the quantum dynamics that happens in the system. So that is how the system can respond to the tuning of the Hamiltonian in a quantum manner through the quantum evolution. But there's another process that the system can respond to the tuning of the Hamiltonian, that's through the decoherence. So when the decoherence is very strong, the dynamics will be governed by the second term. Whereas you tune the Hamiltonian or the pseudo magnetic field, basically the pseudo spin will keep following that. This is actually a manifestation of the Zeno effect, quantum Zeno effect, because what we are doing is that we are continuously measuring the energy of the system. Then because of this continuous monitoring of the environment on the energy sector, then you basically force the single particle state to remain in the low energy bands if you start from the low energy band. Because the Zeno effect basically says that you cannot make a transition if your measurement is too frequent. So that's why in the strong decoherence limits, the state will basically follow the Hamiltonian as well. So that's basically two mechanisms that the quantum system can respond to the tuning of the Hamiltonian, and then also follow the tuning of the Hamiltonian. But there is a case where the system fails to follow the tuning. That is the case when we are very close to the Dirac point. If we are very close to the Dirac point, then the pseudo magnetic field actually will vanish as we go through the critical point. And because the pseudo magnetic field vanishes, so it no longer provides any guidance for how the pseudo spin need to respond. So the pseudo spin will lose track of the tuning of the parameter because of this vanishing pseudo magnetic field. And in that case, the system will fall out of equilibrium. So from this kind of argument, we know that the system only falls out of equilibrium in the close vicinity near the Dirac point. So this is the momentum space picture of the excitation density in the system. So we start before the quench, we start with the system in its ground state. So there's no excitation throughout the whole Brillouin zone, let's say, in the momentum space. But after the quench, because the band gap closes and reopen at the Dirac points somewhere here, then that creates some excitation. That excitation is basically because the system doesn't respond to the tuning. So the single particle state still remains in the original state. But the original state in terms of the new Hamiltonian just look like an excited state. So that's why we have some excitation created in this region. And this region is a finite region in terms of the radius of the momentum. There's a typical radius of momentums, which we call the frozen momentum, that is associated with this region. And the frozen momentum, this kind of the typical momentum scale, will actually depends on how fast you tune the system. If you tune in the system with different quench rates or quench time, then it will exhibit different kind of dependence of the dependence will have different power law behavior. And it also depends on whether your coherence, decoherence is strong or weak. This power law will be different. The system will actually cross over from one power law behavior to another power law behavior if the quench rate or if the decoherence rate is different. So if we substitute the answer into this power law system that for free fermion CFT, this nu and z are both one, then we have this answer. And then we can actually check this answer using numerics. And then we show a plot of the excitation density as a function of momentum and also the decoherence strength. And then we can see in the weak decoherent limit, the typical momentum scale actually just scale with tau to the minus 1/2, such that it remains constant in this plot. But if we go to the strong decoherent regime, we can see a different behavior. And that behavior actually correspond to the fact that this momentum, this excitation range in the momentum space will actually shrink as we go to a larger and larger decoherence. And this is actually a manifestation of the quantum Zeno effect, because if we measure strongly, then the state will more likely to remain in the original, in the lower band without a transition to the higher band, such that this excitation region will shrink as we measure strongly of the system. And the shrinking of this excitation in the excitation range in the momentum space actually follows a new power law, which is derived previously. Yeah. So that is observed. But can we probe this kind of new scaling behavior in experiments? Is there any experimental quantity that we can measure? So we propose to maybe measure the Hall conductance of this non-equilibrium system. So through linear response theory, we can derive the formula for the Hall conductance, instantaneous Hall conductance in this non-equilibrium system. And we can calculate the Hall conductance as we tune the system through the transition. So we consider tuning the Chern insulator from the Chern number equals one, let's say Hall conductance equals one to zero case. Well, at the critical point, there's a divergence, but it will actually saturate to the new Hall conductance in the new phase. So depending on the strength of the measurement or the strength of the decoherence, the behavior, the time scale associated with this relaxation of the Hall conductance is different. So we actually can figure out, we can extract the time scale by looking at this how fast the Hall conductance decays to the equilibrium value. So in fact, the Hall conductance will reestablish the equilibrium value with the power law decay. And then from that, we can extract this typical time scale, the frozen time. So we can plot the frozen time as a function of different quench rate or different quench time. So if we quench the system slowly, which means our quench time is very large, then actually this frozen time, this time scale will basically scale with the quench time in a 1/2 power, which is the Kippo-Zuri scaling, which is kind of known. But if we kind of quench the system rather fast, then the scaling will be different, which is this new scaling. So we propose that maybe it's observable if we look at the dynamics of the topological response of this across the transition. When the measurement is very strong or when the decoherence is very strong, we will see a different scaling behavior. So in summary, we study the quantum critical quench dynamics in the presence of energy-based decoherence, decohere into the energy eigenstates. And then it's governed by a Limbler equation like that. So we found that there is a different scaling behavior emerges in the strong decoherence limit or the strong decoherent regime compared to the Kippo-Zuri. And this is the new scaling of the frozen time and also there's a frozen length scale. So if you consider a certain disorder system, if there's some spatial disorder, then after the quench, it will develop some imbalance distribution of the energy density. So that kind of disorder distribution of the energy density will follow a frozen length scale, which actually will scale in this manner. So this behavior has been tested in our very simple free fermion model, but we expect that the results we presented here is more general, that applies to other transitions that does not emit a free fermion description, such as maybe bosonic SPT transition or even deconfined quantum critical point. So we propose that this may be a way to probe this critical exponent across the transition in the presence of decoherence. So we can probably probe probably observe this kind of exponent or this this power law behavior by measuring the topological response across the transition. So that's what I want to share. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you, Yizhuang. There are a couple of questions. David, why don't you go first?
When you're talking about the Hall conductance, it looked like you showed a divergence at the critical point during the sweep, which doesn't seem to make sense. Whoops, what happened?
Oh, wait.
Did your screen?
Yeah, my screen just.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's on your computer, not mine.
Yeah, okay.
There we go. Yeah.
So this is because the divergent energy denominator that's a system when the gap closes, yeah. So the system become metallic. So.
But you know, during the sweep, if you have a measurement you're making in a finite time, it can't show a divergence, right? So you know, you're doing this during an actual sweep. So I don't see how it could actually diverge.
Yeah. So this diverge is kind of I should say. It's not the true divergence. We ignore factors like dissipation or this finite time. So when we take this linear response theory, we kind of also consider a limit where we integrate over this time for a long period of time.
But couldn't you do linear response and put on an electric field and look at the current as a function of time?
Yeah, then we need to define what is the instantaneous Hall response. Because Hall response anyways, you still wish to study this uniform response and also static response. So you need to integrate over your response over a certain amount of time. So the idea is that you integrate over a range of time which is long enough for averaging out this quantum fluctuation, but it's also short enough with respect to the dynamics. But in our calculation, we take an approximation, we just integrate out this region as if it's from minus infinity to plus infinity. So that may create some artifacts of divergence here. This divergence actually is not very strong, it's just a logarithmic divergence.
But yeah, I would just think. Physically, there should be a rounding out, which probably has.
Yeah. If we take into account the rounding, that's just a peak. That is just a hump. That's not going to be a true divergence.
Right, but that peak might have some interesting scaling if you actually do the calculation.
Yeah, it's like a logarithmic.
Actual dynamic process, right? You could put on a small electric field and linear response, and then ramp through and see what the current is, right? As a function of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but that's not what you're doing. Okay.
Yeah, so we are not really.
Which basically doesn't really apply near the peak.
Yes. We have some approximation that we actually integrate over the time too long, such that they create some artifact of the peak. If you round it off, it's just a hump. And we just want to use this hump and then the half decay position to define a time scale. So all that is important is this time scale, and then we plot the time scale. I think that's a result is reliable. Yeah.
Okay. Ehud?
Yeah, so in your single particle examples, free fermion example, the decoherence rate basically was separable to every wave vector, and it vanished at the Dirac point exactly. So basically your decoherence didn't touch the critical point. But is it clear that in more generally in this, when you have a, interacting system, your critical point is not completely destroyed by this decoherence, or the special form of the decoherence protects it somehow?
Yeah. That's a very good question. So one thing is that we only consider decoherence in the energy eigenbasis. So that makes the problem very special. That basically means we don't really need to re-diagonalize our Hamiltonian. If you're decohering in some other basis, there's a competition of the decoherence and your Hamiltonian of the system, then you may not be able to stay in the ground state, and then all different kind of dissipation effects can occur. So if you decohere in the energy basis, then the decoherent rate does vanish, or the decoherent does vanish when your gap is closing. Because decoherent has to do with the splitting of the energy level. If the two levels are degenerate, then the coherent will be very good. It will preserve the coherent for a long time. So that's why if we kind of consider decoherent in the energy basis, then that's actually a special phenomenon.
Wait, but your gap vanishes, but you have many more non-vanishing energy levels at, say, zero wave vector, and why are they not coupled in this?
Because I think we start from this ground state, so we're not consider a generic state in the Hilbert space. So starting from the ground state, when the gap vanishes, then ground state become degenerated with its excited state, and then the ground state just all this evolution, all the decoherence is also slowed down in that case.
Okay.
So the other energy level highly in the many body spectrum does not participate this low energy physics.
Okay. But I'm expecting that, at the critical point, we have zero gap, but there is a continuum of states above the gap, not only high energy states, but some low energy states as well. And it's not clear to me why they're not coupled and causing dissipation. It's clear to me in the free fermion case, but not generally.
Yeah, but if you consider, but even in the general interacting case, I think you still have your instantaneous Hamiltonian, many body Hamiltonian. If you diagonalize that, pretty much this system, just every energy level just want to decohere into its own energy level, and then there's no much resonance between the ground state and all this excited state. It's because the particular form of the decoherence that we consider here.
Okay.
Even in the many body case, I think. Yeah, of course, that's a very special limit. That's not the most general form. That's what I say. It's like a virtual open system, which only allows to environment only coupled to the system through the energy channel. So in that very specific case, there's this very specific phenomenon. Of course, in the most general case, we may have other coupling of the system with the environment, then it's not guaranteed. Then, of course, the ground state may be resonant into other excited states.
I guess in the interacting system, if you want to couple to the energy eigenstates, you will have to have a very, very non-local coupling to the environment that will implement that.
Yeah, or if the Hamiltonian is like commuting Hamiltonian, maybe that's more, maybe you can couple each commuting projector to the environment, which may still be local.
Yeah.
Duncan?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to check your strong coherence limits. So when you derive a master equation, typically you're assuming weak coupling between your system and your environment. And if you really go to the strong decoherence limit, you can get outside of the sort of, it's basically second order perturbation theory in the derivation of the master equation. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to get Zeno effect in, for instance, in one place it's been looked at a lot is in atomic systems, and to get the Zeno effect, you have to drive the system so hard to monitor it, you basically blow it apart. You have to drive it so hard that it you destroy the atoms. And in fact, what you see more often is something called the anti-Zeno effect, where you speed up the change of state. So I'm wondering if you see any effects of anti-Zeno effect, or if your treatment is capable of handling that. I mean, it's perhaps related a bit to Ehud's question about coupling to other states.
Yeah, we didn't see that in this formulation.
But you believe your treatment is self-consistent, so your this truncation of your expansion at second order is good within your.
I think that's. That's the continuum limit, and that's a different thing, right? Even if the decoherence strength is large, as you take the continuous limit, then you only apply this interaction for a very short period of time, or just perturbatively apply. Even if it's with a very large strength, timing this very small parameter epsilon, it can still be small. So I think in that sense, if you believe these continuum limits, then this derivation should be fine. It's just a matter of we basically pack everything into this coefficient, and then it's just the matter of this how large this coefficient would be.
Okay.
And I believe yes, it's definitely not the most general case. It's very special decoherent in the energy channel, and then the equation will just look like this. So within this equation, within this scope, we didn't see an anti-Zeno effect. Maybe we should consider other more general cases.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I also have one question. So when you derive this classical equation for this n vector, did you average over the states of Ancilla that is uncorrelated in momentum space? Is this?
Oh, we basically start from this Lindblad equation where we already integrated over Ancilla like that. So we just plug in the many body Hamiltonian and density matrix to that. And that for a free fermion system, it reduces to a pseudo spin dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we didn't have additional treatments in this step.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Yi Zhuang for interesting talks, and hopefully we will see you for the next talk in the seminar series next week.